On this episode of Engineer Your Career, we talked to Justin Ayers, a control system engineer at Caterpillar in Peoria, Illinois. Justin graduated from Michigan Technological University with bachelor's and master's degrees in computer engineering in 2009 and 2011. During his time in college, he had internships with DTE Energy and the Michigan Department of Technology Management and Budget. Since starting at Caterpillar in 2011, Justin has worked on electronic control systems for mining equipment ranging from hydraulic mining shovels to large wheel loaders. In our conversation, we talked to Justin about the different roles he has held in control system engineering, as well as the personal system he has implemented to be available to help his coworkers and mentor new employees. Welcome, Justin, to EYC. Welcome, everyone, to this episode of Engineer Your Career. I'm Brendan Timrak, and as always, I'm joined by the great Troy Bauman. Troy.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the show. Really glad that you're listening today. I think we're going to have a really great episode.
Yeah, me too. It's always good to do these, talking to someone new every time. So, yeah, what's new in life of Troy since we talked last?
Oh, man. So it's middle of January now. So students are back on campus, which is always different. It's always the start of the semester. One of the cool parts about being on campus is you get that buzz, right? Everyone's back. Everyone's excited. No one's like overwhelmed with homework. So people are talking and having fun. And so that's one cool part about being back on campus is you get that energy of campus, which I don't know, it's rejuvenating, I'll say, at the start of every semester, especially in the fall, but even in spring.
Yeah. You get like kind of seasons of energy and flow and people, you know, I don't know, coming in, coming out, all being like on the same page. Like everyone on campus is, I guess not everyone, but at least from the undergrad population, I'm sure is all, you know, we all just started a new semester or we're all just doing finals. Like everyone's all along the same path at the same time.
Right. I felt like in industry that was different. Like maybe you'd get it a little bit at the start of the new year when people had a few weeks off and stuff, but it's never the same. I mean, people will maybe will reset a little bit, but I don't know. I always found the comebacks from industry to be not quite as the rejuvenating experience, like when you get together with people, but that was just my experience.
Yeah, I think it's definitely like there's this excitement as you kind of like slide into a longer break period, whether that's over a holiday or something, where people are kind of like, yeah, it's almost like time, you know, we all get a few days off to go home or to be with our families for an extended period of time. But then like when you come back, it's like, all right, we're back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
not quite the same.
It's not like a total new fresh start, right? All the projects that you still had to work on are still there. Whereas when you start a semester, like literally it's all new. It's all new classes.
Yeah.
It's all so. That's been a really cool thing. Just kind of enjoying that. How are things going for you?
They're good. I've started exercising more. That's not necessarily New Year's resolution, since we are recording this in January, but we got some exercise equipment. My wife and I, we're both kind of back on that train. So it's good. It definitely gives me more energy. Get home, exercise a little bit. I don't feel as like tired from the day. So I think it's a positive thing in my life.
That's good. I feel like there's like things about humans that we try to survive. Like for example, like if, you know, we're in a bad state, like our body fights us. Like if we're sick, right, our body will go in and try and fight. Like it has these natural instinctive things that want to make us better. But then there's these other things, like our body hates exercising, which is good for us. So it's like, in some ways, I think our body wants us to live, but in some ways, I think our body wants us to die.
That's an interesting thought. Good point. Our bodies want to live, but maybe our minds don't. I don't know.
Yeah, something like that.
All right. Well, on the episode today, we have Justin Ayers. Justin, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you on. Troy and I both know you from many years back going to school, and it's good to catch back up with you and hear about what you're doing, because I know you are doing some pretty cool stuff right now.
Yeah, we're pretty busy here. We got a lot of different projects going in flight, it's certainly an exciting time to be an engineer.
Well, to start us off, give us kind of the overview of how you got to where you are now.
Yeah, so I graduated Michigan Tech back in 2009 with my bachelor's degree in computer engineering. And at that time, the economy wasn't very good. I had a hard time finding a job around that time. So that was part of the influence for me choosing to get my master's degree. And so I got my master's degree in 2011 in computer engineering. The job outlook, the market was a lot better at that time. So I had interviewed with a couple of different companies at the career fair and ended up accepting a job at Caterpillar in the engineering rotational development program, specifically in the product development program. In that program, I had rotations in electrohydraulic controls, hydraulics research, manufacturing, and proven grounds validation. And certainly after graduating that program, I ended up coming back to the electrohydraulic implement controls group and stayed there for about 6 years working on hydraulic mining shovels. And then about 2 years ago, I moved into my current role as an electronic system integration engineer for our large wheel loader product line.
Wow, that's awesome, man. That sounds like a lot of great experience. It sounds like a lot of companies are doing this rotational program. So can you talk a little bit about your experience in that? How did you figure out where you were going to be placed, and were you able to use that to decide where you were going to end up?
Yeah, so as you were interviewing with the companies, they would market this rotational program. And as you mentioned, a lot of companies have some type of rotational program. At Caterpillar, they have different tracks. So they'll have like a supply chain, a manufacturing track, a product development track. So for the product development track, it's typically anywhere from 1 to 2 year program, depending on your experience. And what you'll do is you'll sit with your manager to determine kind of what your rotations are. You'll first start with your home group, and that'll be basically your hiring manager. And you'll work with him or her to develop your rotations for that program. Some of those rotations you get to choose. They have like a cross-functional rotation, which I chose kind of the manufacturing side of things. But then you'll also have kind of some influence from your manager, because ultimately you're going to be coming back to his or her group, your home group. And so they want and they know the skills and expertise that you're going to need to gain in your rotations to ultimately bring back to your home group.
It seems like a lot of these rotational programs are out there for, especially when they're hiring new grads. I know when I started my job, my manager actually talked me out of going into the rotational program that they offered at GM. But I know like a lot of new people are going into that. And I think depending on the time frame and how long you're in each of those roles can maybe determine how much you benefit out of it. But what was like the biggest takeaway you got from doing that? Because since a lot of people are going into these, I think it's easy to be either like, hey, I know what I'm going back to, so I'll just make it through these rotations. Or there are some programs where it's like, I'm doing rotations and at the end, I'll get a full-time assignment. But what would you say was the big takeaway for you from going through it?
Yeah, a couple of takeaways for me. The first of which, I didn't have an internship at Caterpillar prior to applying for a full-time job at CAT. So I wanted to kind of get a flavor for what CAT had to offer. Certainly, I was interested in controls, but I wanted to also kind of experience what else CAT had to offer. And so the rotational program was something that interests me. Also, as I was interviewing with other companies, I wanted to understand what happened after the rotational program. And in Caterpillar's case, with the product development track, you end up coming back to the group that you started with. And for some of the other tracks, it differs.
Okay, so you got to pick that product development track that you were in then, or was that just because you were hired into that track specifically, or did you get any choice in what you were doing?
So I specifically applied for the product development track based with my background and experience. I didn't think I would be a good fit for supply chain or manufacturing, but the rotations themselves, based on the home group and my skills and experience, I didn't have a whole lot of experience in hydraulics. And if I was going to be an electrohydraulics controls engineer, I definitely have the electric side of things. But certainly the hydraulics was an area that I needed to brush up on. And so a lot of my rotations were focused on building that hydraulics knowledge.
Gotcha. So Justin, let's maybe expand a little bit on that technically for those who are listening. What I would love to hear is what the electrohydraulic controls engineer position is like and what you were doing. But I'm really interested in this idea of your perception of that. And then once you're through it, kind of what it was, what it's actually like. But I guess let's just start with just telling people about what that position is like. What's the day-to-day like? What are your responsibilities? That type of thing.
Sure. So an electrohydraulics controls engineer is responsible for making the machine move. to put it simply. In my case, I was the engineer for the hydraulic mining shovel product line. And so on the hydraulic mining shovel, it's basically a very large excavator that you would see on a highway or in a construction site, but the mining equivalent of that. And so very large machines, couple stories tall, and I would be using software to make the machine move. We would control the boom function, the bucket function, swing, travel control, upstroking the pumps as you were moving an implement. And all of that is model-based code, so MATLAB, Simulink, and Stateflow. And so we would work with our process partners to make sure that the machine moves that meets the customer's requirements.
So are you like kind of drawing out the physics of how this is going to, the system is going to function, or are you designing the specific algorithms for it? What was your kind of like specific role that you had in this electrohydraulic area?
So in this electrohydraulic area, we read in pressure sensors, we read in joystick PWM duty cycles, we read in switches, like implement lockout switch, for example. All of that comes into our MATLAB control model. And I think last time I checked, we have, you know, over 100 inputs that actually come into our model, not only what the actual signal is from a value perspective, but also is there a fault status tied with that? And ultimately, what comes out of our model is we're driving solenoid current commands, which would then actuate a valve to actually make the machine move.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. To expand that for the people who maybe don't know, controls is this idea. I think if you want, let's say you want your bucket to turn left and you want it to stop at a point, it's not as easy as saying go there. You have to constantly monitor it and check these things and control for overshoot. Like, did the bucket go too far? Am I approaching it? Do I need to slow down? There's a lot of elements to controls that are very, very challenging. And so, and to your point, Justin, it sounds like there's many inputs that are a function of that control algorithm that determine how fast is it going to move? Is it going to stop now? Is it going to stop a half a second from now? Does it need to stop due to a fault or like a limit switch or a safety switch? There's a lot of interesting things. It sounds like a lot of that, what you're talking about, is in MATLAB. Is that your primary programming language?
Yeah, a lot of our control models within Caterpillar are model-based. So they used to be just regular C code. Part of the driving factor for moving to model-based code was that we found it was more streamlined to do model-based, what we call model-in-the-loop testing. So on-machine time is very expensive, and we're trying to do more development earlier on in the R&D process. So the more simulation that we can do using our computers or getting into the labs and doing software in the loop, model in the loop, hardware in the loop, testing before we even get on the machine and work out as many bugs as we can, by the time we get to the machine, we can really focus on the stuff that wasn't able to be tested in the lab and ultimately save time and money.
I think that's a good point to point out to people that you're designing this control system for a very large machine that costs hundreds of thousands, if not $1 million, I would assume. And so you can't just go out and drive it around and make sure everything works. You're doing all this work up front before it ever even goes in a machine to say, yeah, we think based on how we assume the machine will move or interact or the variables that are part of that our model will function correctly. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. And to give an example, I mentioned that we read in joystick commands and we ultimately process those into a solenoid current command. We're ultimately modulating the spool of the valve to make the machine move how the customer wants it. And sometimes a customer wants a faster response, and sometimes a customer wants more of a fine-tuned control. So we have various operator profiles depending on what type of application they're working on. Do they want more of a fine control or not? We also have calibrations that are available as well. So over time, if a component wears, we have a calibration routine to get that up to speed.
Wow, that sounds like a lot of things going on. And I think there's a key term, Justin, that you're talking about, this hardware in the loop, software in the loop testing. And I think that means a lot to you when those words are heard, but I think there's a lot of people that hear that and they're not exactly sure what that means. Maybe, do you have an illustrative example of maybe a previous, something that you worked on to illustrate what maybe hardware in the loop testing is, or software in the loop testing is?
Yeah, so I'll speak to hardware in the loop first. So hardware in the loop, really what we're trying to do is get as many of the components on the machine as possible into our lab space so that we can try and replicate the system as best as we can in the lab. So we'll have the electronic control module, the ECMs or ECUs. We'll have a lot of the sensors. We'll have a lot of the control solenoids. We'll use the same type of wiring strategy and really put the actual software on those devices, read in the actual sensors, make sure that we're doing the processing correctly, and then make sure that when we're driving that solenoid current command out of our model, we can trace it and actually measure that current at the solenoid source and make sure that what we're commanding is what actually is being received.
Yeah, that's really important, you know, because it may seem like, well, why do we have to do that? But you can't just wait for a full two-story excavator to be ready to go for your lab to start your testing. You know, it's not practical from a timeline perspective, but there may be a subset of components that would be ready earlier in time, you know, at end of, you know, halfway through the main production phase or whatever, prototype phase, that you can really start a lot of the debugging then. And that sounds like a great tool to be able to do that.
Absolutely. And on the model-based side of things, what we do is we can do a lot of that validation in the modeling world. So this doesn't have the hardware that we talked about with hardware in the loop. It's strictly on your computer. And you're really validating, if I read in my sensors and I simulate those messages in MATLAB Simulink, and I read out those values, does that correspond to what I'd expect? And you can certainly, as you get throughout your R&D process, you'll be able to collect on-machine data and then replay that through the model to actually see what the model response is in case you need to troubleshoot or tune a map.
Yeah, that's really helpful. So I think to summarize kind of how I'm thinking about it is, if there's a term hardware in the loop, it's really this testing of hardware before the full thing is ready to test. Software in the loop, software before the full thing is ready to test. Kind of in the loop is almost this idea of we're testing before the full system's ready. And that's what the kind of the term in the loop means.
Yeah, I'd agree with that summary.
You started out doing this, obviously, after you finished your rotation rounds. And so when you came into this role, what was like one of the biggest challenges you had, or one of the things like that you had to learn kind of like quickly on the job to get up to speed to be contributing to the team and to work on these projects?
So I mentioned this earlier on, but really I didn't have the hydraulics knowledge that I really needed to be successful. And so I had the coding background from my computer engineering degree. I knew my way around a wiring diagram, an electrical diagram, but when it came to looking at a hydraulic schematic, I was scratching my head. And there are some parallels between an electrical schematic and a hydraulic schematic, but I needed to really develop that expertise. And I won't call myself a hydraulics expert, but I would say that I at least know enough to be dangerous now. And I can look at a hydraulic schematic and understand, okay, yep, that's a pressure sensor, or that's a control solenoid, and yep, that's what I'm reading into my model, or that's what I'm commanding from my ECM.
Yeah, I think that's important. I think it's important for people to understand that in your programming, but you're programming a physical thing that's moving. So, you know, imagine you're standing one spot, closing your eyes, and you're going to run forward. And you're going to have different inputs, maybe a person immediately next to you telling you when to stop, or a person who's 100 yards away telling you where to stop, right? Your feedback sensor, just based on where it physically is, can determine your success on stopping at the appropriate place. And that a lot of controls can be about that. Even, yeah, like what, not only does my signal have a voltage of one, but where is it physically, and what does that mean for time delay of where it, of the signal that it's getting? There's a lot of physical properties that you have to understand in order to be successful in controls.
What was kind of your next step after you started in this role? You said that you had a few positions since to where you are now. What was the next step you made?
Yeah, so after completing the engineering rotational development program, I came back to my home group in EH controls, and I ended up staying there for 6 years, which is typically, I think at Caterpillar, we see an individual staying in their role 3 to 5 years, and they can choose to stay longer if they want to become technical experts in that area, or they can choose to move on to a new group and gain experience in that area. I ultimately expanded my role in the hydraulic mining shovel product line within those 6 years. I initially worked on the 6015B hydraulic mining shovel, which is in production today and is doing really well. And I've moved on to other new product introduction programs that we've been working on as we're, you know, updating the product line for mining shovels. And then really gained some experience with working on different machines. That's part of the driving factor for moving into a new position as a electronic system integrator role for large wheel loaders about 2 years ago. I really wanted to get experience with a different product line, and then I also wanted to look at the machine system from a different lens.
So you're now working as an electronic system integrator. Is that your title?
I think my official title in the database is electronic system engineering specialist, but really my true title, yeah, is electronic systems integration engineer.
Gotcha. It sounds like that's more of a higher level role. Yeah, you know, I'm curious to understand the differences in your day-to-day from that type of position versus controls. Are you programming less? Are you going to more meetings? What's the difference in the day-to-day?
Yeah, so an engineering specialist really is the same pay grade as an engineering team leader. I think they're a little bit more technical than a team leader. Day-to-day is very similar to my role back as an electrohydraulic controls engineer. But I am attending more meetings. I'm coordinating with other software developers, so I'm not doing necessarily all the software for large wheel loaders. I have a team of individuals who I'm working with. Now, that's not to say I don't do any software at all. I still have responsibility for a couple of our model-based systems, but in a system integration role, we have machine software features, which aren't, I would say, as complex as some of our control strategies for like electrohydraulic implement controls. The group that I'm in now is mostly coordinating between various subsystems, whether it be implement, transmission, remote control, collision avoidance, those types of subsystems, and making sure that they're interfacing well from an overall machine and from a site standpoint.
What does that work kind of look like in the sense that it's easy to imagine someone, I guess, who's modeling, who is creating code or creating these models and doing work that way to create kind of an output. But when you're doing more coordinating and integration on that side, what does that look like? Since it's maybe not as hands-on technical on the computer, but more of a coordination role.
Yeah, so there's certainly a lot of interfacing with individuals. Typically we'll have a lead for each of the different subsystems that we're integrating, whether it be transmission control, power systems, those type of individuals. We try and get them into a room once a day for our daily stand-ups, where we kind of review what activities we have to get done in a day and if there are any roadblocks to getting those activities done. And certainly touching base with them, making sure that, you know, our system is interfacing well with their system. One of the bigger surprises that I had, you know, moving into this role and moving into engineering in general, and this doesn't necessarily focus on one individual company, but you can have the most complex control system, but if it doesn't interface well with the other corresponding systems, you're not going to go anywhere. And so the importance to collaborate well, making sure that your interfaces between software subsystems are correct. You're looking at data type, you're looking at scaling, interface names, those types of things are incredibly important at the integration level.
Yeah, it sounds like there's a ton of communication. And with Caterpillar being such a large company, are you interacting with people all over the world? Or is most of the team that you're interacting with and having meeting with you in person?
Most of our team is local. We have most of our hubs are in Peoria, Illinois. We have some of our performance and controls engineers up in Aurora, Illinois. We have a pocket of software developers that are our offshore team. They're mostly based in India. And so we try and break up activities for them to work on. It's nice having an offshore team because you're getting more work done in a day. So after my day ends, you know, I have my deliverables, my requirements that I put together, and they can kind of pick up where I left off, or they can be working on a completely separate feature. So it really increases the overall efficiency of software development.
What are the specific deliverables that you have for your job?
So ultimately, our team is responsible for the flash file that goes on to our machine ECMs. So for large wheel loaders, we have a number of flash files that we ultimately compile and provide to the product group and to the end customer and to the factory. But there's a lot that goes into that. And so we're not only responsible for the software side of things, but also coordinating the electrical schematic. So making sure that the pin that we're tying into the ECM is connected to the right power, the right ground, making sure that that pin also aligns to what we have in software too. So I'm talking a lot on the software side of things, but our team is also responsible for making sure that everything's aligned on the schematic side of things too.
It sounds like there's a lot going on in this physical domain. Can you tie this back to your education at your undergrad in computer engineering, master's in computer engineering? Were you taking classes related to the hardware while you were taking software classes, or how did you align that with school, or would you have recommendations for people who are in school right now?
So a lot of the people that I work with today have a mechanical engineer or electrical engineer. I don't work with too many computer engineering individuals. I went to Michigan Tech with computer engineering because I wanted to be kind of the person that's in between electrical engineering and computer science. I didn't want to be programming 24/7, but I didn't want to be completely on the electrical side. I wanted to be kind of a hybrid, and I found that computer engineering was a way for me to kind of meet that middle ground.
Interesting. So when you were taking classes, you were trying to take like pure programming classes, but then also like physics and like more advanced like electrical classes. Is that how you were able to pick your degree classes?
Yeah. So with my master's degree program, it wasn't a research-based program. It was more of a project and class work program. I focused a lot on the programming side of things, actually. So C, C++. I didn't have a whole lot of model-based experience. I got a taste of that during my first year in college, but didn't really work too much with model-based systems, really, until I joined Caterpillar.
So Justin, it's always different becoming a full-time engineer, always working on projects and interacting with people. It's different than what school is like. I guess if you put your hat back on to when you were a grad student, undergrad student, and you looked into the future and saw what you thought work was going to be like, and then now that you've lived it, what are some of those differences? What are the things that you couldn't have anticipated when you were a student that really were reality when you went through them?
Certainly the number of people that are involved in any type of design, you know, going back to my experience with construction and mining equipment, I had absolutely no idea, you know, going into college here, how much software, how much hardware, how much collaboration was involved in that ultimate deliverable. And I learned a lot about that kind of throughout my different internships that I had, not within the construction and mining equipment sector, but two completely different areas. One was with DT Energy in Detroit, and the other with the state of Michigan in Lansing. And as I learned about just the various people that were involved in the overall design of a deliverable, it was really eye-opening to me how important during my education, learning to collaborate, learning about various forms of communication, learning about documentation and how to design software appropriately. All of those really factored into my learning and helped me to be successful in my current role.
Awesome. Yeah, that is a really good takeaways that things are definitely different and they're definitely structured different and the people and the processes and everything. So yeah, I would say I probably had a similar experience starting in my role too. Do you think that what you were learning in school and how it actually played out in industry is a lot different, aside from necessarily the model-based programming that you're talking about? Was it easy to transfer those skills over, or was it like, wow, there were these things that I wish we would have learned, or I wish we would have thought, because it's very different? And I guess that could be technically or process-wise too.
Yeah, a lot of the projects that I worked on, it was usually myself and a handful of individuals, maybe two or three. I don't think I've worked in too many large groups as a grad student. But what I found was a lot of the stuff that I learned in college from a troubleshooting standpoint helped, I would say from a generic standpoint, but a lot of the deep skills and stuff that I learned as a computer engineer didn't directly translate into, I guess, the jobs that I'm currently working at in the professional world. I would say that a lot of the soft skills that I learned when I was in housing and residential life in college directly translated over to some of the collaboration that I had to do, team building, communication. A lot of those skills are incredibly beneficial in my current role.
I think that's an excellent point, Justin, that it's something that I think people don't necessarily think about while they're doing extracurriculars while in university, is this idea that you gain a lot of other additional skills that are going to be relevant to you when you get in the job force. It's kind of it's almost a suggestion to not just do academics while you're in school, because you learn a lot of other really, really important things, like you're talking about, Justin, these soft skills, the ability to work with other people. Because, you know, to be fair to schools, you know, it's not really practical for you to work in teams of 100 people. Like, it's just not going to work logistically. But when you're involved in orientation or these other programs where you're going to be interacting with hundreds of people, or these big projects where maybe the goal isn't a technical goal, you still learn things like, how do I interact with a big team trying to move to from point A to point B? And what's it like to be a part of that? And how do I lead from the inside? And, you know, if I don't have the official leadership title, how can I still help that process by being, you know, a subordinate leader? And I think there's a lot of great benefit to doing those extracurriculars that it's just a great example of what you're talking about there, Justin. That it's a wonderful theme that I think people should take to heart.
I have the privilege of going back to Michigan Tech about once a year for Caterpillar recruiting, and I get the opportunity to speak with first-year students who are kind of going through the MATLAB Simulink courses, and I'm able to at least show them a high-level view of kind of what we work with from a model-based perspective, and showing them how we're using MATLAB Simulink and Stateflow is a direct connection to what they're learning at that time. I think it really motivates them to say, oh, I can actually be using this skill set when I graduate college.
Are you doing any hiring in your role or any interviewing?
So I do get to do interviews. I'm not the person that'll do the hiring. That'll be a hiring manager who will do that. But I get to go on campus once a year, and usually in the fall career fair, I'll go up there. We have an engineering recruiting team. It varies from year to year, but it's mostly engineers and marketing folks, and majority of them graduated from the school that they're going to visit. And so we hire engineers for full-time positions and internship positions. Because Michigan Tech is farther away from kind of our hub in Peoria, Illinois, we usually are up there for an entire week, and we'll do interactions with students in the classroom environment and various career fair activities. We'll visit classrooms and talk with professors, talk with students, and then certainly participate in the career fair. And then we actually do on-campus interviews, usually while we're up there as well. We'll participate in phone interviews as well as needed.
What are some of the key things you're looking for in someone who's applying to work at Caterpillar, whether for an internship or for a full-time position? Are there some of these like kind of standout qualities that you're specifically trying to hone in on?
Yeah, there are a couple of requirements, again, depending on kind of what position you're looking to apply to. But on the engineering side of things, certainly grade point average, we're looking for a 3.0 or higher. But we're looking kind of back to Troy's point. We're looking for an individual really to be well-rounded. So not only are you doing a good job in academics, but I'm looking for what other activities are you involved with, on campus? Are you involved in a fraternity or sorority? Are you a part of a senior design project or an enterprise or housing and residential life? What activities do you do outside of your academics that soft skills could certainly help you in your role within Caterpillar?
I think what a lot of people don't realize from adding on all these other things is it's going to be a lot and it's going to be overwhelming, but that's really, really a good time to learn how to handle that. That's something that I realized when I said yes too many times in undergrad and grad school, where I just got so busy and I was just really, really packed. It really helped me realize what I can and can't do. It helped me realize how to have time management. It helped me realize how I need to effectively delegate and work with a team to accomplish many goals, all in different pipelines, because it works just like that in industry. You're working on this team, but you're on a totally other team, different team at the same time, and they don't know your whole job scope. And you have to manage and balance these things all the time at work. And that's just how life is. And showing that you can do that even in undergrad, where it's, maybe the experiences are different, but showing that you can learn and handle multiple different things that you're trying to juggle is a skill to learn, and that you can do that in college too. And I think signing up for a bunch of other things shows that. And it doesn't have to be all education related. It can still be fun things. It can be intramurals. It can be, sorority life or fraternity life. It can be all these fun things, but it still shows that you know how to handle life and what life is like to manage a bunch of different things.
Yeah. And when I'm at the career fair, oftentimes even first year students who might not have maybe a whole lot of opportunity initially to participate in maybe a professional organization, at least quite yet, they would talk about their hobbies, hobbies that can tie to an internship like programming a Raspberry Pi or something like that. Those are certainly things that you would want to include on your resume, which could certainly tie to an internship or full-time opportunity.
Justin, for you, when you already had your job and you were working at it in 6 years before you kind of moved on to something else, obviously you were working on other skills that whole time while you're working in industry, so you could get up to a position that allowed you to do this coordination, do this integration role. Was there anything you were focusing on specifically to be like, hey, I want to gain experience in this area? I want to, mentor other employees that are coming in, things that kind of prepared you to make that next step.
Yeah, absolutely. So when I was a part of the rotational program, we had a lot of different committees within that rotational program. One is the hosting and recruiting committee, and I ended up being the chair of that committee during my tenure in the rotational program, and that allowed me to take on a leadership position, even though I've really only been at the company for a year or so, and not only talk to individuals who were interviewing at Caterpillar, but also work with current employees to make sure that they were up to speed on hosting and recruiting knowledge for the company.
Sounds like a great experience and to be able to have the opportunity to do those leadership roles when you're young. That's great in such a large organization that they have the flexibility for you to do things like that. I think that's awesome. one thing I'm interested in, Justin, is how you continue to learn while you're in industry. I guess if we go back to the electrohydraulic controls, I think if it's my, I don't know, I guess view being on the outside of controls, that controls, like how you, your control strategy, your controls theory, like those things are changing relatively dynamically. There's a lot of different ways to go about solving the problem of how do we control this system. And I'm just curious as to your thoughts on how you're able to stay up on that technically and how you approach that in your day-to-day, the continual learning.
A lot of the learning that happens in my job is usually on the job learning. I attend some training courses over the years, but most of those were safety related courses. Like if I'm going to a mine site, I have to take, you know, MSHA training, mine safety training, functional safety training, making sure that our machines are complying. But as far as learning, for example, the control models that I dealt with in college were very small in comparison to the control models that I was exposed to when I first joined CAT. And so I needed a lot of handholding initially to work my way around the different processes that the company had, learning about the tools, how are we version controlling software, how are we managing our requirements, how are we testing our software, those types of things. And so I really leveraged the skills and experience of my coworkers to teach me. And it took me, I would say, probably 6 months before I really started feeling comfortable with taking on ownership of what I would call easier to medium sized features within the application, and probably felt more comfortable taking on advanced features probably after a year's time.
Sure. So the importance of having those mentors, whether it, I don't know, it doesn't always have to be formal too. Sometimes companies will have like, here's your mentor person. Maybe that's more in internship settings too. But I think once you get into the workforce, it's amazing the power of having a mentor. So I'm curious, Justin, on your perspective on how do you be a good mentor? You know, now that you're in the point where you're, you know, you're probably technically mentoring people, but you've recently gone through the process of having a bunch of people, as you kind of described, handhold you, but mentor you to the position you're in. How do you become a good mentor? What are some of the key traits of that person?
I think the key to becoming a good mentor is being approachable. I've had a lot of people, interns and newer employees who I've worked with in the past. And one of the first things that I say is never feel like you're bothering me with a question, because I'm incredibly busy every day, but I will be more than happy to stop what I'm doing to help you out and make sure that any roadblocks that you have can be resolved. And so I would say, out of anything for me, that approachability factor is key.
I totally agree. Yeah, I think it's because it's really hard. I think it's, and I'm curious as to your thoughts on this, Justin, but how do you do that? Like, I've been in industry and I've had people come up to me and it seems like I'm in the busiest day. I have a bunch of stuff going on. I got my head deep in the computer and I look over and I can see a younger person struggling and I know that I could help them, or they're asking questions that lead me to believe they don't understand what's going on and they could use a little handholding or a little help. Mm-hmm. But it's always so hard in those moments for me to be like, I'm so busy right now with my own stuff. How do you prioritize that in your mind? How do you say, no, I'm putting this down? Like, what's that thought process in your mind?
So if someone comes up to me and needs something of me, usually if I'm certainly in the middle of something, I'll try and really quickly jot down a note. I use OneNote to track my action items for the day, and I'll write a quick note on maybe what I was doing. And so they might see me typing a note to myself before I actually turn my head and actually actively listen to what they have to say. And it's not that I'm being rude by not, turning my head right away, but I certainly don't want to lose track of what I was doing. Now, there are times where we have maybe a machine down or a line down in a factory that's requiring my attention, and I will make a point to let them know that, hey, I'm in the middle of something right now, but I will get back with you in an hour or so, or feel free to put a half an hour on my calendar later today or tomorrow, and we can work together to resolve it.
Those are some really good points. I think I could honestly probably benefit from those myself, thinking about situations where it's hard. It's hard to tear yourself away from what you're doing, especially when there's repeated distractions over and over from different people throughout the day. Even sometimes when you're maybe not even as busy, just having people come up unexpectedly. And so I think what you're doing there with keeping track of where you're at in work is important, because it's easy to get distracted and forget where you're going. But also your comment about offering people another solution. If now isn't the right time, when? I think there's lots of situations where I've gone to people and now wasn't the right time, but there was no when. And it's like, okay, if there's no when now, then I'm just going to come back in an hour, a day, a week. When do I come back? So I think that's really good.
Or worse, never, you know. Yeah. Worse, they think, you know, Brennan just shut me out. He has no interest in helping me, which may totally not be the case. It may have just been the wrong time. And I like that system, Justin. It sounds like you have a system in place to be successful so that you can help people, and you prioritize that system. And I think that's excellent. I think that's great advice for the starting person to be able to appreciate that when they walk up to someone and ask a question, but also for those people 5, 10, 20, 30 years, 40 years out that have a lot to give the community that they sit in. So Justin, when you were young, how did you go about then approaching people? You know, you talk about this idea of how to be a good mentor, which I think is excellent, but what advice would you give to the starting engineer who wants to ask for help but doesn't necessarily know how?
Yeah, that's a really good question. The engineers that I work with, each of them have different personalities, and sometimes it's helpful to kind of sit there and be in an absorb or a sponge mode where you're sitting back and observing. And it is hard sometimes to ask for help, certainly, especially when you come from college and you've been involved in so much for so long, and you had a lot of the answers, where now you're being exposed to maybe a completely different environment and need some hand holding. Be honest with the person about what you know and what you don't know, and then that'll allow them to help you. But also keep in mind that it's helpful to be challenged. And sometimes struggling on something for a period of time is helpful in your overall learning of the material, kind of like in college as it is in the professional space.
I think that's great advice. A couple of the nuggets that I really liked from that is this idea of learn the personalities of the people around you, because that can be a great way to figure out how you're going to ask them for help and when you're going to ask them for help based on just their personality type. But then also this idea of don't go and ask people for things that you haven't struggled on a little bit, because then they won't necessarily think that you're appreciating their time, because they want to know that you've struggled with it sufficiently, because you know, you don't want to just waste people's time. And I think if you come to someone and said, hey, I've been working really hard on this, I've spent time, but I'm really stuck, that's different than, hey, the manager just said, I need to do this, how do I do this? That's, you know, those are different situations and different questions, and that people will appreciate the former over the latter. And I think that's a good illustration that you showed there.
Yeah, I'm certainly willing to help a person who's really struggled through it and thoroughly lets me know what they've tried, what they have been struggling with. And I can maybe not give them the complete answer, but maybe point them in the right direction to remove that roadblock and let them continue down the path of learning.
What other advice do you have for someone who's looking to get into this type of controls work that you're doing, whether that's specifically for you or maybe even in another role at Caterpillar or another industry in general? What's something that you would say to someone either coming out of college or someone looking to make a career transition into that? What is the one piece of advice you would have for them?
There's a lot of learning that can happen in various ways. I'd encourage, certainly, if you aren't involved in controls or MATLAB Simulink and Stateflow in your coursework, and that's something that's of interest to you, you could enroll through your college, but there are also free classes that are online, be it YouTube or Coursera or any of those various websites that you can certainly do a lot of learning that way. Project-based is important as well. So if you have, you know, certain projects that you want to get involved in, be it a professional organization on campus, I'd certainly encourage that. I was a part of the Integrated Microsystems Enterprise, and that allowed me to get a little bit more of the hands-on hardware experience that maybe I didn't have as a computer engineer, where I was maybe more focused on the software side of things. And finally, I would say that, you know, career fairs are a great way to connect with recruiters in person. So even if you aren't just looking for a job, you know, that given year, networking with recruiters or other industry professionals, I think is important, be it face-to-face or even online. You can use LinkedIn or other websites to do that. And finally, I'd encourage individuals to certainly get internships, summer internships or co-ops, where they can really learn to understand what they like and, equally important, what they don't like.
I think that is so true. The value of knowing what you don't like is incredible. And I think it's not often viewed like that. But I totally agree. I think it's super, super important to know what you don't want to do, because then you don't have to get stuck in it for however many years. But an internship is a great opportunity to do that. To me, Justin, it sounds like this controls type engineering is probably happening all over the U.S. Do you know if there's geographic regions that this is tied to, or sounds like there's companies kind of all over the U.S. if you have an interest in doing this controls type engineering?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm mostly talking in like the construction and mining equipment application, but controls engineering happens all over. I'm sure it's very prevalent in the automotive industries and generator business. You could go on and on. Anything really that has an ECM in it, be it an airplane or a boat or whatnot, you know, it's going to have software, it's going to have hardware tied to it. And there are people that are strictly focused on making sure that those devices work appropriately.
Gotcha. Well, I think we're coming on time. Justin, we really appreciate you coming on the show, man. I think you have some really, really excellent advice technically, but also those soft skills. I really enjoyed that about our conversation. Really want to thank you for taking the time.
Yeah, thank you, Troy. Brennan, appreciate you having me on the show. I really appreciate the work that you guys have put into these podcasts. I'm confident that they're going to be really beneficial to students, not only looking into engineering, but looking at their careers as well. So thanks for having me.
Awesome. Thanks, Justin. It's great talking to you. Good luck.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. A lot of stuff that Justin talked about in our interview really kind of hit home for me. He talked about, I mean, the technical parts, but a lot of the soft skill stuff that he was talking about.
Yeah,
like, I feel
great.
Like that's so true that it's something you don't always have experience with until you really start in your career.
Yeah, I think it's awesome to be able to get that feedback. And I think I really like doing this podcast because it's helpful for me too, because I feel like it makes me just slightly better because I'm thinking about these other things like soft skills. I thought the way Justin brought it out, I thought was excellent.
Yeah, his comments about his kind of system for allowing himself to be approachable to people come up to ask him questions really hit home for me. I think I find myself in my day-to-day sometimes being a little cold to people who come up and ask questions unannounced, being like, I'm working on something, I have something going on. But I don't have a kind of a clear cut system as he did. I like how he's like has a system. I'll make a note so I come back to it. Or if now is not the right time, I will tell them, hey, come back later time, make an appointment or something. I think that's something I could definitely benefit from in my interactions at work.
Right. I think it's a very big philosophy, right? It's the group collective over yourself. And I think that's really, really hard to do. I mean, I'm not saying that people are selfish by not helping others, but I think it's important to realize the power of the team, and the team can accomplish so much more than the individual. And in order to grow the team, we have to sacrifice individually. And I think he didn't say it necessarily like that, but it's this idea of he needs to support that. And so he's a logical guy, which I love about him. And he's got these systems, and that's his system. He's like, okay, I see this better future. In order to do that, I need to set up systems to make that successful. And here's how I'm going to do it. And I think that's awesome. I totally agree.
yeah, it sounds like it's really, really working out for him, which is awesome.
Another thing I thought that was really cool from Justin, especially, I guess, juxtaposing it to Eric a couple episodes, you know, Eric was a software engineer, computer engineer, and then, you know, Ayers doing a similar thing, but so very, very different in that it's around these models, these physical models of these components moving and this model-based programming and, you know, this idea of like hardware in the loop testing. I imagine Eric would do like software in the loop type testing, but how do you actually tie that into hardware? And it's cool to see where you could go. I think this is a, you know, one of the great examples of the podcast to date of how you can have like a base degree, but you can do two totally different things with it. And I think it's really cool to see that, really cool to see how that's different, even though the degree titles might be similar, even the job name might be similar, but you can do very different things. And I think hopefully this podcast will help to illustrate more of those and how you can just with a certain degree do widely different things. Like maybe you're still interested in programming, but you can do it different ways. And I think that's awesome. And I know that to be true. And I think this podcast is really starting to show that, especially with these two interviews.
Yeah, I think when this specific skill set we're talking about, it could be you could be working at YouTube like Eric, working on something that billions of people are watching a day, millions at least, or you could be working on multi-story mining equipment, because a lot of it all requires, you know, it all requires this computer knowledge, this code at the end of the day to make it all run. And it's pretty cool. It's pretty cool how you could be doing such different things, and it especially could align with your interests. If you're interested in machines and like physical products, but you're also interested in computers, this could be a great route to do it. Or if you're interested in, you know, the web and software programs that people interact with, like you can also do that route too. I think it opens up a lot of doors for people.
Right. And the fact that you don't necessarily need to know that freshman year, right? This idea of, well, I think I kind of have this interest. Like you can still start down that path. You can even get into senior year, even get through the bachelor's degree probably, and then be able to still decide which path I'm going to go. But it at least helps you to understand what direction you're going to start walking. That's a different way I like to visualize it, is this idea of you're standing in one place now, right? You could walk anywhere. You could walk straight at 0 degrees. You could walk behind you at 180 degrees, but you're going to start walking, and you can walk, you know, 100, you know, turn around and walk 180 degrees for a little while, realize it's the wrong way, and then turn around and walk back towards 0 degrees. But it's best if you obviously try to walk in the general area of interest. And hopefully this podcast starts to help people understand the general area that they might want to start walking and what is down that path.
Definitely. I couldn't have said that better myself.
That's why I'm here.
Exactly. Exactly. Nice. Awesome.
All right, dude. Great to talk to you, man.
Yeah, you too.
It's fun,
you
fun too. To talk to old friends too. That's awesome to hear people. For the, you know, Justin recently had a kid, and it's, I think it's awesome for him to take the time. Another example of how awesome Justin is and this sacrifice self for the greater good. He, you know, I think it's great that he's willing to do that, and really appreciate him taking the time to come on.
Definitely. Yeah. He's always thinking about other people. Like that about him.
For sure. All right, buddy. Well, hey, enjoy your week. I'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, you too. See you next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks for listening to this episode of Engineer Your Career with Troy Bauman and Brennan Timrak. For more information about the show, visit our website at eycpodcast.com. There you can find show notes for each episode and get in touch with Troy and I. If you or someone you know are an engineer with an interesting or even not so interesting career journey and would like to be on the show, go on the website, send us a short bio, and we may just invite you to come on and share your story. And finally, if you want to show your support, please rate, review, like, or subscribe to the show on your podcast player of choice.